Alright. You guys ready? Just kidding, we weren't ready. Now we're ready? Are we ready now? Okay, 2 minute meditation and then the prayer. It'll be up there by the time we're done with the meditation. Okay, prayer. God, please lay aside everything I think I know
about meditation, alcoholism, the big book, the 12 steps, this workshop, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all of these things. Help me see the truth. Amen.
All right, this one's called Beginning. This is the moment of embarking. All auspicious signs are in place. In the beginning, all things are hopeful. We prepare ourselves to start anew. Though we may be intent on the magnificent journey ahead, all things are contained in this first moment. Our optimism, our faith, our resolution, our innocence. In order to start, we must make a decision. This decision is a commitment to daily self-cultivation. We must make a strong connection to our inner selves. Outside matters are superfluous. Alone and naked, we negotiate all of life's travails. Therefore, we alone must make something of ourselves, transforming ourselves into the instruments for experiencing the deepest spiritual essence of life. Once we make our decision, all things will come to us. Auspicious signs are not a superstition, but a confirmation. They are a response. It is said that if one chooses to pray to a rock with enough devotion, even that rock will come alive. In the same way, once we choose to commit ourselves to spiritual practice, even the mountains and the valleys will reverberate to the sound of our purpose. So, at the beginning, we say the lay aside prayer, the set aside prayer. It has a bunch of different names, but what's important is that in it is that we set aside what we think we know. We set aside what we think of our experience. We set aside what we think things are going to look like. You may have an idea of what this weekend's going to be, how it's going to look. That's fascinating because neither Tarek nor I have any idea what this weekend's going to be or how it's going to turn out. Because the crazy thing is that spirit resonates all the time. We don't know what you need for us to tell you, to present to you, to challenge you on. But you tell us through your Spirit. Now, it may not be a visible outward sign of anything that you're doing, but we pick up on it. It's fascinating because we'll sit up here and there'll be some guy in the middle to the back who's been not paying attention all weekend long. And it's almost as if a flare gets shot up when the guy comes online. Something we said connected, and it's like, whoop. And it's like, whoop. And it's visible to us. Something in my spirit communicates with something in your spirit, and we connect. And then all things change. But that's just the beginning of it, and you have to proceed from there. So, prejudice. It was explained to me, and I still use this, as preconceived ideas and opinions. Okay, that's all prejudice is. Is I have programming within me that thinks that I know what something is. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. It's a lot of words. It didn't make any sense to me for quite a long time. I had to start reading it backwards, because then it started making sense to me. The principle of contempt prior to investigation, which is prejudice, or thinking you know something, cannot fail to keep you in everlasting ignorance, because you will manufacture proof against all arguments, and that principle doesn't matter what information is presented to you, you are resistant to it. One of my favorite quotes of all time, it's not a direct quote, but it's essentially Henry Ford said that if you believe something to be right or you don't, you're correct. If you believe that this weekend is a bunch of waste of time, you're right. If you believe that there's information in this weekend that may change your life, you're right. And you will, in your own mind, manufacture all sorts of reasons to confirm what you know. Okay? I had a wonderful experience with my stepson not that long ago that helped prove this point. Somebody want to be come up front and let me use you as an example for something? I have a volunteer. Anybody? Oh, wait! I saw him first. Well, I don't know. He's got a. Is that a New York? All right. Hey, you can come too. Come on. You guys can both do it. Come on. Because two examples is even better. Okay. So, real simple. Stand. Like over there by that light. And I want you guys to touch the ceiling. Okay, now keep touching. No, like maintain. Okay, now put your face on the ceiling. Okay, now wait right there. Now, hold on. Okay, you're going where I meant. So I did this with my stepson. Is he believed that he couldn't do something. Okay? I told him he was right. I said, touch the ceiling. Now, he's about yay tall. Our ceilings are regular height in our house. And he's like, he can't even jump up and touch the ceiling, right? And he's like, I can't. I'm like, try. And he's like, doing this. Well, what I did, is I did this. Look. What was the difference between what he was doing and what I was doing? He believed he couldn't touch it. And he didn't believe that there was even a possibility to touch it. I walked over to a bar stool. I stepped on the bar stool and I put my whole face on the ceiling. You guys were going there. You guys were proving to me that you were willing to do anything to make it happen. Now, I don't know about you guys, but you guys, thank you. Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but when I was drinking, even my kid's piggy bank wasn't safe when I needed to go get some more. I stole his third or fourth birthday $20 bill and then acted like I lost it or it was missing or something else. And magically, a week later, I found it, right? It had fallen behind the dresser because that's where I put it when I got it. An extra $20 back, right? You see, I would do anything to get my fix. We've got a buddy that I guess it was late 2000s in Atlanta. There was a huge, huge rainstorm. 285 was flooded, like impassable, right? And this guy had gone out bowling. The fire had been lit, right? He had been doing some shots, and it was time to go visit the crack man, right? And the universe, through a rainstorm, a flood, traffic, all this stuff in his way. And you know what? He made it through it, found the dope man, went to the hotel, and then made up some crazy-ass story about being kidnapped and tying himself up. Oh, it's a great story. If you ever meet this guy, you're going to go, oh, yeah, I've heard this before. There was nothing stopping this guy from getting his fix. Okay? The only difference was that he believed he could get there. You want to get clean and sober and have a life beyond your wildest dreams? It has to be possible to you. And once it's possible, then it's achievable. Then you can do it. But if you think we're up here and we're just moving our mouths and that we're full of shit, you're correct. We are. So maybe we'll get your attention. Hopefully that little charade that we just did, and again, thank you for the two demonstrators that could only partially touch the ceiling some of the time versus me being able to do something a little. See, I had a little planning involved in that. There aren't just ladders laying around out here. You actually got to set that one up. But again, I had a belief and I had knowledge of how to get there, and I made it happen. And that's what we have to present and offer to you today, this weekend.
So what we're going to try to do tonight is cover the first step, which is a daunting task to cover in the next 45 minutes or so. So there's a couple of different options I typically take here. I can take you to a few places in the book to look at the physical craving or a phenomenon of craving. We can look at the mental obsession on a few pages or the strange mental blank spot. Which I think sometimes we focus on obsession a little bit too much. Because if I think back on my experience, I bet you the strange blank spot came for me just as often as the mental obsession did. But we seem to focus on this, like, obsession is the when it's us against them, it's like the obsession. Do what I have to be in fit spiritual condition so the obsession doesn't look for me. But sometimes I wonder if we like lower our guard because the strange mental blank spot is such a sneaky son of a bitch. You know, that's why it's called the strange mental blank spot. You don't see that shit coming. But what I do, about 2 years ago, and I don't know if I've done this at the Bridges before. I can't remember. But I created 2 years ago, was it last year? The past 2 years when I've gone through the steps, it's been with a group of guys. There's four of us. And we go through the steps, and we do it in 5 weeks. So the first meeting, there's like an assignment leading up to it. And the assignment for that was we were supposed to read from the preface all the way to page 63 where the third step prayer is. And as we were reading, anytime a question appeared in our mind or our consciousness, we were supposed to write it down. Didn't matter what the question was. So by the time I got to 63, I had over 100 questions that had come into my consciousness, but 21 of them had to do with powerlessness. So what I did was I took those 21 questions and I have a page number, and I came up with this little sheet. And I don't use this with a newcomer. Like, I'm still old school when it comes to a brand new guy. I want to take them into, I don't do the book line by line, but I do the pages I need to do to get the teachings across. And I give them, so this will get into step 12 a little bit. Like, when I sponsor a guy, he's got a spiral notebook. And when he meets with me, we put meeting number one, the date. This is what Tarek and I covered. This is my assignment for our next meeting. Why do you? Does anyone want to take a stab of why I do that with the guys I sponsor?
So you can have a sponsor.
Exactly.
Boom.
Boom. I need them to be able to recreate the experience with another person. And that's the way I do it. And I just have them every week. That's what they're, when we meet, that's what they do. Because one of the things that terrifies people once they've been gone through the steps is they think they're terrified to sponsor someone. So, I mean, it's a tool that I use to increase their confidence a little bit. So they're willing to start going through it. Because most of us don't understand that we are going to learn through trial and error. Now, our hope is that you use your sponsors. You know, I've got sponsees right now that call me. I mean, I've got two guys, you know. This is what I'm doing with the guy next week when I meet. You know, I just had a conversation this morning with one of them. Like, they're sort of running by what they need to do at the next meeting. It's my job as a sponsor now to help them through that process.
I've got a sponsee that he's 4 years sober. He sponsored a ton of guys. And I swear, almost every time he gets to the fourth column, he still calls me and says, "Hey, remind me again, what's the difference between self-esteem or... selfishness and self-centeredness." And I tell him, and he goes, "Thanks," and hangs up. Like, 4 years he's been sponsoring people, and it's like, would you take some notes, please, right? But another thing I wanted to point out too is Tarek keeps holding this up, talking about this book. Just to be clear, this book is this book. He's just had it rebound, okay? So when he's holding this up, he's talking about the same big book that you got. It's just that he's had it rebound with missing a bunch of stories and things like that. So when he's holding that up, it is this. It's the same thing that you are all required to carry along with you for first 30 days. Sorry.
No, you're good. So by going through these questions, I'm really addressing two major questions when it comes to powerlessness. What happens to Tarek after he starts? Does he lose power, choice, and control over how much? That's the physical. It has to do with what with substances in my body. What can I not control? And for me, it was a lot. Like Xanax, Valium, Klonopin, if I had access to it, I wasn't going to control how I did that. Oxycontin, if I had heroin, wasn't going to be able to control it. Crack cocaine or cocaine in any form, absolutely not. And alcohol, believe it or not, too. Like if I went to happy hour 10 times, I was going to drink more than I intended to drink 7 or 8 times out of 10. I was going to overshoot the mark. What I intended to have happen when I opened the door to the bar and I came in was not what ended up happening. Right? So there's a physical loss of control there. And as far as page 21 in our big book is concerned, I'm a real alcoholic. Interesting, right? On page 20, it says, what about the real alcoholic? He may or may not start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some point during his liquor consumption, he begins to lose all control, right? Somewhere along those lines. And if you're looking at the first step that way in powerlessness, then I'm a real alcoholic. But then I like the description on page 24. And interesting, there's a bunch of important words, but the paragraph starts off with most alcoholics and drug addicts have lost the power of choice in drink. For reasons, they say, obscure, like reasons we don't understand, our willpower becomes practically non-existent. At certain times, which are the three most important words in that paragraph, Tarek cannot bring into his consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the humiliation and pain of a few hours ago when it comes with hard drugs, a few days ago, weeks ago, months ago. Tarek's without defense against the first drink or the first thought of crack cocaine. So what do you guys think is the most important, the three most important words in that paragraph? At certain times. I remember sitting in a big book study at Dante's house on a Monday night. What was that? Did you hear that?
Yeah. Speaker on?
It's like.
I told your dad not to.
It's not coming from my phone, I don't think.
I think it was.
Oh. TV going on?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Something happened. And God spoke. We're the speakers.
So I'm sitting at a big book study, and those words jumped off the page for some reason at certain times, and it was terrifying because I think the way it went down is like I was like, oh shit, I don't know when those times are. How do I guard against that? And you can't. And that's the night where I realized that I was going to have to do the 12 steps like I smoke crack. Because they're telling me that like a spiritual experience and being in fit spiritual condition is my only defense against that first thought. Like once I start thinking about crack in a way where I'm plotting and I'm envisioning and all these things, I'm done. And so my degree of willingness at that point escalated. And for years, this idea of choice has always stumped me. I'm going to get to these questions real quick. I'm going to let you go probably then come back. But let me finish this one more. So when I'm sponsoring people, when I was sponsored, for me to understand the phenomenon of craving was simple. All right, I mean, for me to see that I don't have any control when I'm high and I'm using, and I've awakened the beast or turned the fire on. There's so many metaphors that we can use, but when that fire lit up inside of me after I started, the only thing that was going to turn the fire off was running out of money or physically being stopped where I've been up for 5 or 6 days and my body just craps out on me. And I go out. That was typically the only things that were going to stop when I was in the middle of a run. So easy. Oh, yeah. Once I start, I can't stop. No choice. Powerlessness, being compelled. I get it. But then when it comes to like, this understanding intellectually of not having a choice before I start, I can sit and say, yeah, I get that. But I know from the guys I've sponsored over the years when they relapse and I come back, and one of the first questions I'll ask them is like, did you choose to relapse? And they'll say, yeah, of course I chose to relapse. And I'm just like, well, you haven't understood the first step on an experiential level. You've only maybe slightly understood it on a conceptual level. Well, I'm going to explain to you what it looks like to not have a choice. Because we think of this thing like, I don't have a choice. Then we're like, it doesn't, especially in a Western culture, it does not compute. Right? But here's how a typical, let's say Friday morning when I was in corporate America, right? I used to have this job. I was an analyst. It was a really nice job. I had a putting green in my office. It was a good job. It was a springboard to possibilities. Well, many weeks on a Thursday afternoon in the office, someone would say, "Let's go to happy hour," and we'd go to happy hour on Thursday night. We'd all get to this bar. We get there about between 5 and 5:30. By 7:30, I have clearly overshot the mark. I have overserved myself. And everybody else I came with is going home. And I'm there. And about 7:30, I start itching. I want to go downtown, right? And so, let's say on a Thursday night, and this did happen many times in my experience, I go buy $100 worth of crack. I go back to the house. I smoke. Fuck, I go back down, get another $100. Go back down, get another 50 rock. Next thing I know, it's like 5:30 in the morning, right? And I'm tweaking. And I got to be at work at 8 o'clock. And so I had this ability. I don't call it a gift. I call it a curse. I had this ability to where I could chain smoke a bunch of cigarettes. I'd eat a Xanax bar, eat a Klonopin, and take a shower, and put my work clothes on. And I mean, I'm driving to work, and I go in, I take the elevator up. I try not to make eye contact with the receptionist in our reception area. I try to beeline it down to my office, close the door, put do not disturb on the phone until I'm done tweaking about 9:30, 10 o'clock. And then I can take do not disturb off the phone, and I can somehow try to work. And I did this for 2 years before they finally fired me. But let's say I had one of those Thursday nights, hadn't slept, come to work, take do not disturb off the phone. And then around 11 o'clock, I get this vision of just taking a blast off a stem, right? I'm just thinking about getting high again. And I make a choice. So what does the word choice mean to you guys? A choice, would you guys agree that choice is an intellectual sorting out process where you examine options and you either accept them or reject them? Isn't that how you really make a choice? If you really use that definition and go over the course of your day, you'll see how very few choices you really make throughout the course of a day. And that's a baffling thing. That's for a whole nother subject. But, so, when that vision comes to me, what happens is I have access to the intellectual sorting out process. I spent too much money last night. I still owe my roommate money from last month's bills, and I got mom's birthday coming up this weekend. This is a for real experience that happened. And so I'm talking, I was like, no way, I'm not getting high tonight. Not getting high. I make a decision. I have access to my willpower in that moment. I go back to the computer. I'm doing some work. A couple hours go by and I start playing, you know, like the whole ritual of driving downtown and fucking pulling over to the side of the road and taking a blast before I even head home and all those wonderful things we used to do. And I say, no, mom's birthday. Spent too much money last night. Still owe money for bills. I reject the idea, right? And then about 3 o'clock, one of the guys I know down on the block sends me a text and says he's got something for me. He's got some butter for me. He's got my slab for the night. And that whole thing starts, and I go through the sorting out process again. I examine my options. I say, I don't want to do this. I have access to my willpower. I make a choice. The workday comes to an end. And I go to my car in the parking garage, and I pull out of the parking garage, and I go down to the traffic light. And if I go straight, I go home. If I go left, I go downtown. And the same intellectual sorting out process I had access to, let's call it willpower, was practically unavailable to me in that moment. It was like I just went, and I drove downtown. There was none of that shit that went on when I was thinking in the morning about pros and cons. No making a choice. So in that moment, my willpower. So now, when the big book says, at certain times, we will not have an effective mental defense against the first thought of drinking or drugging. That's scary because we have no idea where those are. So all that does is it made it so clear that I have to attack the 12 steps like I attacked getting high. There's no option. There is no middle-of-the-road solution for me. I can't do the one-foot-in, one-foot-out shuffle. I just can't do that. I don't survive. I just do not survive the game living that way. And so that is the quickest way I can show you guys an illustration of the phenomenon of craving, right? And the mental components. I don't want to call it obsession. The mental component of what we're up against. Right? Because that paragraph on page 24 that we just went over is probably the most important paragraph in the first 54 pages of the big book. Right? They devote 54 pages to one step. And it's all about the powerlessness. You've got the 8 pages in the doctor's opinion, and you've got the first 44 pages. Right? So that's what? That's 52 pages. 52 pages devoted to one step. But what I did was consolidated all that into really that. And they do it again on page 44. But that mental piece, right? I mean, the physical, the answer is complete abstinence, right? But it doesn't work for a real alcoholic, right? Or the alcoholic or addict with no power. Because remember on page 21, they said the real alcoholic is someone who has the physical craving. But then on page 24, it says most alcoholics got this other piece too. The mental piece. Now you're truly fucked. Right? But this is good news. we all, and this is where I'm going to have to use some profanity, we all have to see how fucked we are in our first step. You should not leave the first step in a good mood. That should not. I want a guy to be like, fuck, I am so fucked. And the reason I want him to think he's fucked is then you're willing to do whatever you have to do to unfuck yourself. And the way we unfuck ourselves is steps 2 through 12. But we need to see how fucked we are in the first step. All right? And I mean, guys, I don't like to cuss, but that lands much deeper when I say it like that. Right? And the reason I use that word in that example is because I have no other words in the English language to get my point across right now. That's what the first step. There is no hope in the first step. Right? No hope in the first step. The cold, harsh reality of all this is the more hopeless you are coming out of the first step, the better chance you have. That contradicts the world we live in, right? That's a paradox. And this program is full of paradoxes. I am going to get to these questions. I'm going to hand it over to Brandon for
a
minute.
The big book uses doom, but I agree. Fuck just sounds a whole lot worse, right? So, I've been to plenty of meetings, and people talk about the hope in the first step. And just like Tarek said, I do a lot of exercises with guys to get them to see it, okay? I have them write out their experience of all the ways that they've tried to stop or moderate. And if they come back with less than 20, I tell them to get the fuck out. Because, like every single one of you are in the middle of one more way, okay? Bridges of Hope is one more way that you're going to try to get sober or clean, okay? The list of ways that I attempted to stop or moderate, the book's got a bunch of them, right? Take more exercise, you know, read spiritual books, do all this self-help stuff. What you will see if you really, really look at your first step is that you've tried everything and nothing's worked. Guaranteed, 100% of the time, what do? Go get fucked up again, right? Okay? So the only thing that can really get you to that place is your experience and the analyzation of your experience, right? So bottom of page 38, it says, yes, Brandon and Tarek, what you tell me is true, but it doesn't fully apply. You might admit that you have some of these symptoms, but you have not gone to the extremes that Tarek and I did. Nor are you likely to, for you now understand yourself so well, and what we've told you of such things, they can't happen again, right? Maybe you haven't lost everything in life through drinking and using, and you certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information, right? Perhaps that's where you are. And so maybe our experience isn't lining up with your experience, but look at your own experience. What have you tried? What has successfully worked? I'll tell you none of it because you're here. Right? People don't call me to get good news from me. If they call me and they hear a little chuckle on the other end of the line and I ask them the question, do you really want to know what I think? What they get after that is cold, hard truth. What's the first thing a lot of people do when they get sober? They're feeling kind of depressed, not so good. You want to feel better. Don't. Feeling better is bad. Because then you have no motivation to get the shit done. You should be depressed. You wrecked your life. Some of you are here for 6 months or longer. That's not good. Right? So then it goes on and it says that it was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. I went to the hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple cocktails with dinner. Just a little bit, right? So, what does it look like when that thought hits and it gets removed? See, because we all know what it looks like when it happens and we act upon it, right? Well, the good news is that if you work these steps and you get a connection to something, I'll call it 100 different things over the course of the weekend. You can call it God, you can call it universe, you can call it spirit, Tao, whatever. You get a connection to this thing, whatever it is for you, then something different happens. So there was my parents used to live up on a lake, and I was the grill master, and everybody's upstairs in the house. They're laughing, they're having a good time. It was the end of a perfect day, right? Families together, enjoying the lake. It's one of those beautiful evenings where the sun's coming off the water, reflected up just nice, air's perfect. I'm grilling. Ah, this is the life. And the thought comes, it would be nice to have a beer. Right? Not a lie. It would be nice to have a beer. Problem is, Brandon is not capable of a beer. When Brandon, I heard in a meeting one time, a guy said, I really wish I wasn't an alcoholic because I'd go get fucked up right now. And I was like, huh, that's right. Because I don't want a beer. I don't want two beers, right? I want to get fucked up. So at first I had that little chuckle of, it would be nice to have a beer, right? Thought stays. Oops. All I have to do is walk up these little 5 stairs, walk across the patio, go into the rec room down there. There's the beer fridge. It's stocked. I could probably have a beer. Nobody would know. Uh-oh. Thought sticking, right? So we hear all these fancy things that we're supposed to do, right? Supposed to pray. Supposed to call 3 people. Do all that stuff, right? Like the addicts, you know, they're going to call 3 people, right? They're going to call the dope man, the hooker, and the hotel, right? That's 3 people. They told me I need to call 3 people. Right? So, thought stays. Right? I should probably call somebody. I should probably call Tara. Well, that was the weekend. That was Saturday night. Monday, I'm sitting down with a sponsee, and I'm relaying this story to him, and he says, what happened? I said, what do you mean? He goes, what happened? I was like, I don't understand your question. He goes, well, you didn't drink, did you? I said, no. And he goes, so what happened? Did you call somebody? No. Did you pray? No. What happened? And it was so perfect because in that moment I realized, holy shit, nothing happened. I don't know if a boat came roaring through the cove. I don't know if somebody came down the stairs. I don't know if the grill flared up. Thought was removed. How many times has that happened in the 9 years, almost 9 years I've been sober? I don't know. Because nobody's ever asked me what happened, except for that one time. So when you get access to whatever this thing is that's actually keeping you sober, something happens to where the thought is literally removed. It doesn't exist anymore. Right? And so that's what we're talking about, and that's what happens when you actually get hooked up with whatever that power is. Okay? So if you're sitting here, that power has not, you've not gained enough access to it, right? As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink or drug. This time I had no thought of the consequences at all. Right? How many times has that shown up in your life? How many times have you said, how the hell did I get here? and you can't explain it. That doesn't happen to me anymore. That not Tuesday, last two Tuesdays ago, I can say with 100% certainty that if that man had stepped on my front porch, I would have ripped his throat out. Absolutely no thought in my mind, it would have happened. Okay? That rage would have filled me so much that I could have done it. But what instead happened was a calm came over me, and the second email he had sent us in the day, I was able to respond to in a very professional, sound-minded way. The same thing stepped in for me. Okay? This isn't just about not drinking and not drugging. It's about gaining access to a life that gives you something that you do not have a need to drink and drug anymore. And that's what we're selling you. Because that's what we're doing up here. Is we're selling you on God, really. And the way to access that is through these steps. Now, we hear all sorts of things in meetings and in rooms that are not true, but they sound true. Okay? We're going to debunk a bunch of this stuff over the weekend, but you don't have to raise your hands, but how many times have you heard things like this? That meeting makers make it. That if I work steps 1 through 9 one time, then I can stay sober in 10, 11, and 12. That alcoholism and drug addiction are the same. Possibly that you recover, or maybe that you will always be recovering. Drug of choice. Right? I'm sure that Tarek had a nice little elixir of drugs that he preferred. But then he had his master. Right? I can get to a place where I can think the drink through. Think the drug through. Play the tape through. Right? Do you believe alcohol and drugs are concerned? You have a choice today. Tarek's already spending a bunch of time debunking that one. Is the desire to stay clean and sober the only requirement you need to stay clean and sober? Is there such thing as a living amend? Ask yourself, what is service? Perhaps there's somebody in here who has God all figured out. Knows exactly what God is. Who thinks that they actually can remove their character defects? Who really knows what the problem is? That we can stay clean and sober just one day at a time. That triggers actually exist. That relapse prevention programs work. That preventing your next relapse is possible on your own with that relapse prevention program. When we're talking about the program, what is the program? When do the promises really show up? This one, I love having this conversation. I need a family, a job, a car, a phone, whatever, before I can focus on recovery. Keep coming back actually works. You need to have a year before you can sponsor someone. And by just showing up at a treatment center or a meeting, you have worked your first step. And Tarek kind of covered this one already too. That acceptance is the answer. Over the course of the weekend, we'll challenge what you believe about those statements.
So these, those, we call those, that's our myth-busting section. which will, you know, throughout the course of the weekend, you may hear something that says, oh yeah, that's why they said that. We may want to consider that's a myth. But they have sources, right? So somebody came up with these, and I don't think the people that came up with these were trying to hurt anybody. It's just in my experience and Brandon's experience, they've proven not to be true. Does that mean that there aren't people out there in whose experiences that they may be true? Yeah, absolutely. I also know the type of addict that I am. And so I surround myself with people who are traveling in the same direction as me. Well, let's see, what's another way of putting this? So there are people that use the same book. There are people that are on the same page. And there are people that are on the same paragraph. And there are people that are reading the same sentences. And I stick close to people who are reading the same sentences as me, the same sentences as I'm reading at the same time. Does that make sense? A ton of people use this book, but they will have different interpretations and believe different things. The way my mind used to work was it was easily diluted by what I was seeing sometimes. So you got me bouncing in and out for 3 years. I'm hanging out with a bunch of people that just go to a meeting and go out to dinner after every meeting. And they seem to be getting better. And I need to act like I'm getting better, but something inside of me is just getting worse. Right? And that's why I think for years, you know, as soon as the opportunity presented itself, I'm getting high. I mean, I'm the guy that smoked crack in the sober living house, the halfway house. I got high when I was in treatment. But it was because, like, I listened, and, like, these people weren't trying to hurt me at all, but they would say things like, stick with the winners. I was like, okay, I can do that. Simple, right? Just hang out with people that are going to meetings all the time. They must be the winners, right? And for me, I thought abstinence meant you were winning. Abstinence has nothing to do with victory in this game. What we're going after here is a conversion experience or a transformational experience. And there are traditionally three views when it comes to this stuff. There's a group of people out there that believe we should be re-socialized. You take addicts and alcoholics and you put them in a community of sober people and they like sort of help keep each other sober. That's one traditional model of drug rehabilitation and alcohol abuse rehabilitation. I guess that's how you say it. And there's another group that focuses on psychological trauma, right? Clinical. If we can go in and figure out what happened to you and your family of origin stuff, and I think this stuff is vital. Once you've been on the spiritual path for a while, you've got to address. You can't have spirituality without psychology. Impossible. But not to focus on it on the front end. But there is a model that says that's the core. If we can fix that, if we can heal that trauma or integrate it, then the person won't use drugs as an anesthetic or alcohol anymore. And then you have a group of people that have influenced me, which are the ones that you need to have a vital spiritual experience, right? That's what we're talking about here. And so over the years, what I've come up with is, I think it's like a melding of the three models. You know, because I tend to spend the majority of my time with people on a spiritual path headed in the same direction as me. That would be that re-socializing aspect. I didn't choose that, but that's the way what my life has evolved into. Is like I prefer to spend time with people traveling in the same direction as me. Why? Because I'm less likely to get off the road. In early recovery, in those 3 years, I didn't even know what direction to go in. So I went to the meeting makers make it direction, and it didn't work for me. Right? And the way I approach these 12 steps is demanding. It is a commitment. And if I'm spending my time with a bunch of people who aren't devoted to a deeper, more meaningful experience with God, and there's nothing wrong with this, but I believe some people want the car back, the phone back, the family back, the money back. And once they get all those things, they're good. You know, I've had all those things, and I've lost all those things in recovery. But thank God that the spiritual experience has always been my thing. Like, I don't know why, but that's the way it's been for me. I'm glad it's been that way. And so I do think the social re-socializing piece is important today, but not in early recovery. I mean, we want to hang out with people that are in our fellowships and stuff, but the focus, like, it can't be all. Like, the fellowship by itself is like a warm bath. It doesn't last for long, right? So you have to answer the question, do you believe that the fellowship by itself is enough to keep you clean and sober? Well, clearly, my experience abundantly confirmed to me that it wasn't. And so I did the psychological trauma work. I did that inner child work. I think it was the second time I was in treatment with my family. My mom, my dad wasn't there, but my mom was there. And we acknowledged it and we spoke it. We spoke about it. We interpreted it. We tried to give it a meaning. But whatever we did not work because I used again, right? And so the focus on that didn't work. But I'll tell you what, I revisited it when I was 3 years sober. And the effect produced by that psychological work with a therapist to address being molested when I was 5 and 6 and 7 years old, it did something it allowed me to integrate that experience into who I am, where I'm okay with it today, right? For whatever reason, when I was trying to do it with no spiritual work, no effect was produced. I'm 3 years into a spiritual path, and I go back and do the same inner child work and the same forgiveness work and the same healing work, and it works. There has to be some connection with that, right? 3 years of spiritual work called the 12 steps. And then the conversion experience is, you know, that's where I think things should be. And that's what I love about this Bridges, because there is emphasis here on let's go through this process. Enough of us will wake the fuck up. You know, you'll have an awakening just enough to change the way you look at the world for long enough for you to take a series of actions you've never taken before. That's what we're looking for here. And boom, you have this conversion experience. And so, I think, you know, I do want to go through these questions, but I feel like we've covered, like, that first half of the first step pretty well tonight. And I don't want to beat, you know, the proverbial dead horse. Is that the saying? Mm-hmm. But if somebody would like me to email these questions to them, I will. I have page numbers, but they're really good for you to diagnose with the help of a sponsor, or it's a good exercise where you can go through and sort of see what's going on with your relationship with drugs and alcohol, and you can look at them separately. Do you want to cover spiritual malady? How do you want to do this? Or you want to kick off in the morning? Or... because we got another 15.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to all right, so I don't... we'll start... meeting makers make it, right? Like, I don't even know where to start to explain what I'm getting ready to explain around meeting makers make it. So... because of where the guys were when I was taking them through the steps, when the whole world decided to not exist as it had been forever, and we all did this thing called social or shelter in place, and all the meetings stopped, I hadn't been to an actual physical meeting with people where we share and we talk about the book and stuff. Now, I'd met with sponsees, but I hadn't actually been to a meeting in like 2 weeks at that point. Okay.
Disclaimer. Okay. As you're listening to him, this little voice might go off in your head that says, Brandon is telling me I don't need to go to meetings on a regular basis.
Yeah.
That's not what we're saying here. Brandon and I have been doing... I can't speak for Brandon, but I'll tell you guys, and I'm not exaggerating, in the first 90 days, I did 180 meetings. Not 90 and 90. I did 180. And I probably did average 5 meetings a week for the first 3 years of my sobriety. Because I loved going to meetings. Not because I needed meetings to keep me sober, but I had caught fire with the big book and I wanted to shove it down everyone's throat. And I can tell you that's what I was like back then. Right? I was going to tell you how you were doing it wrong and my way was better and it's all about the book. And if you're out of the big book, you're fine. And if you're not, you're going to hell. You know, and of course I'm making light of it, and I didn't like say it like that, but that is what I embodied back then. But I'm saying that because, you know, yeah, I go to my home group now, and I have a men's accountability group that I've been in every Sunday, you know, every Sunday for 7 years now. And so just because Brandon's about to tell you he hasn't been to a meeting in a while, don't let that, because he was going to, you know, probably 4 or 5 meetings in the first few years.
Oh, more than that.
So
yeah. Yeah. The disclaimer will come kind of at the end, and you'll understand what I'm saying. So 2 weeks prior to the world shutting down, I hadn't been to a meeting, okay? I have not yet been to a physical meeting, okay? This is the first, literally the first physical meeting I've been to, recovery-related, in over 3 months, okay? So based on that premise, I'm not making it, right? Because meeting makers make it. So Brandon should not be making it, okay? Now here's where the disclaimer comes in. If we were to go through my phone, I guarantee you there's not a single day, other than maybe the weekends, because I like my time, where you do not see at least 3 to 10 people in recovery. Some of those conversations lasting over an hour, where we're talking about something on the spiritual path. My meetings have taken a different form. They still exist, but it's not a physical, let's share about traffic and how irritated you get because she's doing this and, oh, there he goes again. He's going to, I just know it, he's going to bitch about his brother-in-law. Yep, there it is, bitching about his brother-in-law. And then he talks about traffic and here it goes, traffic, 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 the next 5 shares, right? I've not been to one of those meetings, but the amount of spiritual interaction through conversation on the phone has not ceased, okay? And the reason why I want to tell that story is because when I was talking to Sean the other day, he said, crumb snatcher.
Oh, yeah? I've heard that in a long time.
And that's what I said. So, years ago, this guy named Mike D. from California is doing a workshop, and you know how you're watching a movie or a show and you see the character kind of break into one of those soliloquies, you know, where he's just gonna give a speech that you're like listening to and you're enamored with and you're like, wow, that's fascinating. Well, it's that happened to Mike in this one workshop, and he's talking about a cake. And he's like, you know, I'm a kind of guy that I want the whole cake. He said, I don't just want a piece of the cake. He's like, I want the whole damn thing. And he goes, you know, we go to these meetings with people that they're fine with just a little sliver of the cake. He's like, and then there's the other people that they want the whole cake. And he said, and then you got those people that are just hanging around the outside, just hoping to get a little crumb. Those little crumb snatchers. Okay, so what Tarek's talking about is he hangs out with and experiences other people that want the whole damn cake. Right? And let's finish the cake and let's go make more. And let's explore different ways to make the cake. But what we experience in the rooms a lot of the time is a bunch of people that they're just fine with it. Can I have a little bit of that frosting over there? Thanks. And that's all they want. And they're okay with a little bit of frosting. And there's nothing wrong with the people that just like frosting. Everybody's seen that little kid that doesn't want any of the cake. He just wants to lick the top off the frosting. And that's it. And that's okay. Wherever you are is wherever you are. But what we're telling you is that we come from this place where we want more, okay? And once you get a taste of the really, really good, like, who in here, like knew that guy that almost died from some dope? And, like, then they wanted to find out, where did he get it, right? Yeah, so he died, but he didn't die all the way. And where was he getting some? Right, Like, you guys are the guys that want the whole fucking cake, right? Like, I'm full. No, no, that doesn't exist. I'm going to have more cake, please. Right? And so, it's, you go to meetings with a bunch of people that the meeting fixes what they got. Right? And what they share to you is their experience. Right? When they sit there and they say, just go to a meeting and everything will be okay, they're not lying to you. That's how they live their life. Right? Maybe they're a guy who, his wife died when he was in his 70s, and he was drinking too much to deal with his loss, and the kids were like, Dad, I think you got a problem, and you're an alcoholic. And he goes to this lunch meeting, and he finds other guys that are really welcoming and friendly around his age that go to lunch after the meeting every day. And he now has this group of people that make him not feel lonely anymore. Guy's not an alcoholic. He was just drinking too much for a little while. Maybe fell down the stairs one time, and the family got concerned. Okay? So that guy shares in the meeting, yeah, man, we go to this meeting, then we go to lunch, you'll be set if you do that. And he's telling you the truth. That worked for him, right? And then you have these people that maybe they go to some meetings, they pray in the morning, they put their shoes underneath their bed so that they have to get down on their knees to get their shoes. And then they pray, and that worked for them. You know, maybe they help somebody move and it's service work and that's enough for them to get through it. They're not lying to you, okay? But if you got what we got to the level that we got it, that's not going to work for you. And maybe nobody's ever told you that before. And that in order for you to get the cake, you got to figure out how to make the cake and how to tell somebody else how to have the cake and make the cake and share that cake with somebody else. But if you just want to be a crumb snatcher and get a little bit off the side, cool, that's okay. If that doesn't work, we have a way that does.
All of the individuals he just described, and he stated this, I don't know if he used these words, they're all welcome in our fellowships. Anyone is welcome. But I have a theory, and I haven't done anything to prove it other than talk about it, that a great number of individuals that come into our fellowships may not be real alcoholics and real addicts. And it sounds like I'm being very judgmental. But I think there's two things we're looking at here. Chronic addict. Chronic alcoholic versus acute alcoholic. And acute addict. Acutes, they look alcoholic and like they're an addict while they're using. The big book calls the acute hard. Hard drinkers and hard drug users look very much like an alcoholic, very much like a real addict. And I'll give you guys an example, and I want to read something. We're going to end there. I dated a girl for 2 years. She taught me, I was selling a bunch of coke at the time, and she taught me how to cook. So needless to say, we were smoking a lot of crack. And I mean, she could stay up for days. She smoked like I smoked. You know, we would get high using other drugs. I mean, she could outdrink me. If you said, Tarek, will you bet your right wrist? Like, you can chop my wrist off if I'm wrong, but this girl is a junkie just like me. She's the real McCoy, right? Now, the big book's very clear on this on page 21. It says, if a sufficiently strong reason, like ill health, falling in love, instructions from a doctor become operative, this person can stop or moderate although they may need medical attention. And so, when was this? This was sometime at the end of 2005, early 2006. Her dad, who was a very wealthy person, comes into the picture, and he thinks I'm a piece of shit, but I was a piece of shit at the time. And he's like, if you don't leave this guy and move back to Alabama, Tuscaloosa, you're cut off financially. I'm done with you. And I'm telling you guys, that was her sufficient reason. She moved back. She got back into nursing school. She graduated with a nursing degree. She got a master's in nursing. Now she's married and has two kids. And to my knowledge, has not smoked crack since. All right, and I'm still friends with some people that are friends with her. I made my amends with her. That was 11 years ago. But from what I hear, she's doing really well. But damn, remember the wrist? I would give my right wrist. I tell you, she was just like me, and it turned out she wasn't. But I had every sufficient reason in the world, right? The threat of the incarceration, losing my home, finances, relationships, everything, like careers, all of it. Sufficient reason after sufficient reason, and I was unable to stop or moderate. So I lost power, choice, and control over how much once I started, and once I stopped, I could not stay away from the desperate experiment of the first one because I couldn't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory. And so no matter how great the necessity or the wish, I always went back because I'm a chronic and she was acute. And so these people that Brandon's describing, I think, can maybe fall in that category. The deal is not everyone that comes into our fellowships has to work the steps like Brandon and I work the steps, or like Bill or Jay or Roscoe, But I like to be around people that's got to do something that resembles what I got to do, because that's what I'm talking about, getting it with your people, getting with your immediate family. I got kissing cousins and I have immediate family, all right? Know who your immediate family. What I mean by that is the people that are traveling in the same directions. We have like-minded views. Not that we look at things exactly the same, but Bill, Roscoe, Jay, Brandon, and I can sit down and tell you that you got to work the steps as outlined in the big book. You need to do your best to make all the amends you're consciously aware of. You need to learn how to be self-aware. You need to learn how to pray and meditate, and you better sacrifice your personal time helping others work these 12 steps. Now, what we do inside the confines of what I just said may be a little different. But we all are going to agree 100% on that. And no, that's five people headed in the same direction, traveling on the same path. So from the beginning of time, there have existed these two types. Acute problem drinkers or recreational drug users or drug users have a serious problem. But when they see the destructiveness of their drinking and using and make up their minds to quit, they do, and they can stay sober on their own. They don't need to constantly help others or sacrifice their personal time. They don't need to work the steps on a regular basis. They don't need a home group and to attend group conscience. They don't need a sponsor that they communicate with on a regular basis. Even though, from time to time, they may indulge in some of these activities. These actions are optional and not a matter of life and death for these individuals, but they are welcome in the fellowships. On the other hand, there is the chronic problem drinker or drug user who, no matter what is at stake, no matter how sincere the desire, they eventually suffer from their abstinence to the point where they, in a desperate move, will return to drinking and using time and time again until it eventually kills them. They are locked up or take their own lives. These are the people who programs such as AA were designed for. If you can stay sober without it, that's a good thing. But please don't hold it over those who will die without it. The people that welcomed us with love and open arms into a fellowship I needed, but some people don't need. Who knew? So the reason I read all of this, and the reason I believe Brandon shared all that with you, is find out what you got and try to find people that sort of got something that looks like what you got, because the actions they took might be the actions you have to take.
And don't be afraid to let some of those that you're connected with fall by the wayside when you no longer have a use for them. The 10th step buddies, we'll explain a lot more of that later on in the weekend. The 10th step buddies that I have today are different than the ones that I had when I got here. There was a group of guys that kind of got sober around the same time I did that we talked almost every day. Okay? And then one of them started having kids. The other one got married. Different circumstances in their lives started popping up, and our paths changed. And then I found a new group of guys that was going the way that I was going. And then that path changed. I don't know who said it, but if you look at the 5 closest people to you in your life, it tells you who you are and how you're living your life. Okay? If you look around yourself and the people that you're surrounding yourself are not headed in the correct direction, drop them. Find some people that are. Because they're out there. And what so many people do is they get sober with a group. We'll just use this room. They come in with a group of guys around about, say, March 1st through 8th. And these are your guys. These are the guys that you're hanging with. And at some point in time, you start to realize they're not serious. They don't really want to do this thing. You can start hearing it in their words. You can start seeing it in their actions. But these are my boys. If your boys go get fucked up, you probably will too. Pick new ones. You will be surprised. Some of the guys that are just showing up now, a month from now, are going to be your greatest asset in recovery. You do not know where these people are coming from. Some of my closest, best friends that I got, I didn't know 3 years ago because I didn't sponsor them then. They come into my life. We start having... I take them through the steps. The thing transitions. We start becoming 10th step buddies. We start sharing more of our life. Now we talk just about every day. That group of people in my life has changed a multitude of times. And it will always be clear to you when somebody's fading away and somebody new is coming in and they're the spark that you need to keep going. The guys that have pushed me the most on my spiritual path are the guys that I sponsor. Because they force me to dive deeper, to understand more, to go figure more stuff out, because ego, my thinking mind, doesn't want them to catch me. Thank God for that. Thank God for the guys that want to push and challenge me. I pray that you find some in this room, in this place, with the people around you.
All right, I think that's a good stopping place. Have a good night. See y'all tomorrow.
I have a question for you.